Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Let's start this week's Web Wisdom Show off with philosophy behind Fallout 4 via Wisecrack. Let's listen and learn.
Hey everyone, Jared here, and today we're talking about the black hole that devoured weeks of my life, Fallout 4. Like many of its predecessors, Fallout 4 follows a vault dweller bravely traversing the post-apocalyptic wasteland. Unlike Fallout 3, which features a vault dweller in search of his father, Fallout 4 chronicles a weird inverted Oedipal scenario where you kill your son and destroy his legacy. All Fallout games feature super mutants, death claws, and feral ghouls menacing the human race. But in Fallout 4, there's a new danger. Synthetic humans. And while the perils of the wasteland still pose an existential threat to humankind, Fallout 4 introduces a new, purely philosophical threat. That is, what does it mean to be human? Through the synths, the game makes us question everything we know about our very humanity. Welcome to this Wisecrack edition on the philosophy of Fallout 4. The Synth Creating Institute serves as the primary antagonist to the rest of the Commonwealth. The Institute was built when the surviving scientists of a fictionalized MIT, known as CIT, dug themselves underground to shield themselves from the ravages of the irradiated surface. Dedicating themselves to research and the advancement of humanity, they quickly scrapped their plans to improve life on the surface and instead opted to create serene waterfalls and creepy synthetic children. The Institute's synth program draws suspicion from the inhabitants of the wasteland, who believe correctly that the Institute is replacing their loved ones with synthetic counterparts.
What have you done with the real Riley? Where's my brother?
It also sets them at odds with the Railroad, who believe the synths are sentient and being exploited by the Institute, and the Brotherhood of Steel, who feel the synthetic humanoids are another case of technology gone too far. The fundamental question about synths and our relation to them falls into two camps. There's humanism, a philosophy centered on, surprise, the human, and posthumanism, the deconstruction and decentering of what it means to be human. As the player, one choice faced in the game is to believe, as Father does, that the synths are mere robots. Or you can believe, as the Railroad does, that because they've developed sentience, they're deserving of rights. We could see the synth storyline as an uninspired, lazy cliche about discrimination.
I'd never be friends with a damn synth.
But it also does a great job of exploring the line between human and non-human. Nowhere is this divide explored more explicitly than in the ideology of the Brotherhood of Steel and their opposition to the Institute. The Brotherhood are, for lack of better term, synth racists.
Shoot to kill!
They believe the cybernetic organisms are an abomination to nature.
The synth, a robotic abomination of technology that is free-thinking and masquerades as a human being.
And it's not just the fear of them being used by the Institute to spy on society. Even the rebellious synths, shepherded to freedom by the Railroad, are targets of Maxon's soldiers.
If we intend to end the synth menace, we need to plug the leaks.
Walking around Brotherhood territory with Valentine, an early version synth, subjects you to a deeply unsettling level of harassment.
Don't get any ideas, synth.
The Brotherhood ride around on the Prydwen led by a guy named Arthur, a reference to the ship and hero of the Tales of King Arthur. Their ranks emulate medieval Europe with titles like Knight, Paladin, Scribe, and Squires. This is perhaps the best indication of how they perceive themselves. Chivalrous knights out to battle monsters and protect the helpless remains of humanity and its purity. The Brotherhood adopts a kind of classical morality. They believe in the human as a pure, inherently valuable entity worth defending. Conceived in a womb by a loving mother, au naturel, you get the idea. They can be roughly described as humanist. Now, there are tons of different kinds of humanisms who all believe different things, but we're really just using the term humanist to stress a level of assumptions they share with the other humanists, that there is a basic human nature, and that the human, as opposed to the inhuman, are the primary subjects of the world. If the Brotherhood is so bothered by synths, it's because this amalgam of man and machine threatens the very identity that defines them and the humanity they seek to defend.
Flesh is flesh. Machine is machine. The two were never meant to intertwine.
Long before the Brotherhood, humanity was obsessed with defining themselves by what they are not. We're not like animals because we use tools, think abstractly, and use emojis. Back in the days of ancient Greece, this anxiety mainly manifested itself in interspecies creatures like centaurs and minotaurs. The combination of species disrupted the traditional boundaries of Greek society between man and animal, polis and nature, etc. Today, that anxiety about the boundaries of the human creeps into our relationship with technology. Instead of human versus animal, it's more like human versus animal slash machine slash microbe slash holy shit, the world is scary stuff. A quick survey of the sci-fi genre will reveal a ton of movies scared shitless about human genetic manipulation, machines overtaking humans, machines fucking humans, you get the idea. In her essay, The Cyborg Manifesto, philosopher Donna Haraway investigates our construction of the human and how this chasm between organism and machine is always enforced by a kind of border war. We defend the figure of the human against degradations, impurities, infections, and so on.
By attempting to play God, the Institute has taken the sanctity of human life and corrupted it beyond measure.
It shouldn't be surprising to learn that back in the day, people argued that dialysis was an unsavory attempt to play God, an unholy marriage between man and machine. Life-saving technologies are often considered undignified.
Is he still right?
Oh, no, no. He has health problems.
Uh-huh.
In order to preserve their idea of pure humanity, the Brotherhood wants to exterminate the synths, who threaten these boundaries. The Brotherhood's defense of the human isn't all that new, and their response to synths isn't too surprising. They're essentially railing against miscegenation, or the mixing of races, using the same invocations of purity in nature that have always worked so well when being dicks to entire groups of people. However, the Brotherhood's idea of human is deeply flawed and full of contradictions. It's here that Fallout gets pretty smart, even if inadvertently. The game, through the Brotherhood of Steel, shows the distinction between human and inhuman isn't so black and white.
I don't recognize you.
And calls into question several myths surrounding the very idea of the human. The first myth the Brotherhood runs into is about the purity of the human body, shunning the mixture of flesh and machine as we discussed earlier. The problem is, they're literally cyborgs. If you want to rail against the post-human, let's talk about your suits of power armor that you wear around everywhere. The power armor enhances the human body like any implant could. It can augment your vision, your strength. For Proctor Ingram, it even fills the void of the missing legs she lost in battle. For Haraway, this boundary is always a fiction, and the biggest enforcers of the border between human and inhuman are gleefully ignorant of how porous that border is. Those things that make us human, using tools, language, etc., are seen in both apes and birds. We're also molded, according to Haraway, by the environment.
Would the Commonwealth corrupt you? As it has everything else.
In real life, the pure human body is full of foreign DNA and bacteria. Likewise, the radiation wreaking havoc on the DNA of wasteland survivors makes them as impure as the synths created with untainted DNA from Sean. The second myth is about human nature and morality. Maxson argues against Dance's humanity on the grounds that
those ethics that it's striving to champion aren't even its own. They were artificially inserted in an attempt to have it blend into society.
For many humanists, there's either a human nature which makes us innately good, or at the very least, a free will which enables the possibility of ethics. Unlike animals or machines, we can choose to be virtuous. Maxson criticizes Dance for having artificially inserted ethics. The irony of this, coming from a man raised in a heavily regimented military organization, where higher powers dictate a code of ethics to a set of subordinates, seems to be lost on him.
If you intend to stay within our ranks, you need to obey our tenets without question.
For Haraway, our entire being is crafted by the cultures, societies, and environment that we come into contact with. For instance, exploring Kellogg's memories and his traumatic upbringing can tell us as much about who he is as his cybernetic implants. If the Institute inserted a set of ethics in Dance, is it all that different from the ethics instilled in us by our parents, our church, or our schools? Technology invading human nature is a constant fear in real society, and constitutes the third myth espoused by the Brotherhood. Using tools is what allowed us to evolve into who we are today, and the technologies we developed along the way, like agriculture, architecture, and manufacturing, shaped us as much as we shaped the world with them. Before the synths, the Brotherhood manifested this fear in their distrust of technology, believing the pursuit of science to be a reckless transcending of human limitations and control.
These monstrosities are just another example of man blindly taking a step forward, only to wind up stumbling two steps back.
Yet at no point does it register for them that flying around a blimp stocked full of nukes might also be an act of hubris. The figure of the synth creates a rupture in our understanding of the human, complicating these myths. For Haraway, this is a good thing. Our rigid conception of human is what allows people to ostracize ghouls and enslave synths in Fallout, and has justified centuries of oppression against racialized others.
Whoa, no ghouls in Diamond City. Get that thing out of here.
Haraway argues for a cyborg politics, one that rejoices in the illegitimate fusion of animal and machine. In other words, instead of denying that we're cyborgs, we should embrace it. We're not only the fusion of flesh and machine, but society, history, and culture. The Institute, even if accidentally, manages to confront us with this pollution of the human. Father leaves you a synthetic version of himself for you to raise as your own child. The synths, who we're told are mere automatons, bristle for freedom regardless of their categorization. Even the fact that synths are built using actual human DNA further blurs these boundaries. Valentine, who is aware he is living with somebody else's memories planted in his artificial mind, struggles with what it means to be, knowing that he and his past are fabrications.
As I was Nick Valentine, I had his memories, his fears, all that poor bastard's hope. Then I discover all those things that they weren't even mine. All the good we've done, that's ours, and ours alone. And even if that's the only thing in this world that I can ever claim as mine, not Nick's, not the Institute's, but mine, then I can die happy.
And then there's this speech from Dance.
It's true. I was built within the confines of a laboratory, and some of my memories aren't my own. But when I saw my brothers dying at my feet, I felt sorrow. When I defeated an enemy of the Brotherhood, I felt pride. Don't you understand? I thought I was human, Arthur.
Perhaps the most interesting lesson we can draw from Fallout 4 comes from the story of Pinocchio. In Pinocchio, a wooden marionette strives to become fully human. It's only when he learns the human traits of selflessness and honesty that he's finally transformed. Fallout offers a few parallels. There's Curie, who wants to become a real human.
I must embark on a great adventure. I must become human.
But settles for her brain being downloaded into a synth. Then there's the relationship between Father and the synth Sean he built, which somewhat parallels the relationship between Geppetto and Pinocchio.
Do you think you could love him like you would a real boy?
Both Dance and Valentine ground their claims in humanity, like the story of Pinocchio, in their human values. And what better metaphor for what it means to be human than a puppet who only becomes a human after he learns to obey his father and accept society's rules?
From the philosophy of games to the reality of poverty, let's listen to Philosophy Tube's take on the question of, should the rich help the poor? Let's listen and learn.
The difference in wealth between the rich and the poor is the biggest it's been in a long time, and people are suffering and dying because they don't have enough. It is the case that if wealth was more equally distributed, a lot of that suffering and death could be avoided. But does that mean that the rich should help the poor? A concept I want to introduce you to today is Henry Hsu's idea of basic rights. Pick any right you like the right to free speech or the right to remain silent. You can't enjoy that right if you're dead. If you starve to death, you can't use your right to free speech. In fact, even just the threat of taking away your health or your food or your house could prevent you from freely exercising that right. The idea that some things are necessary in order to have rights is nothing new. The founding father Thomas Jefferson, drawing on the philosopher John Locke, said that the citizens of the new United States should have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, from which followed a lot of their other freedoms. Hsu says that because using your rights requires a certain standard of survival, nobody can really enjoy any rights unless things like healthcare, shelter, and food are guaranteed. He writes, "Because actual deprivation of subsistence can be so very serious, potentially incapacitating, crippling, or even fatal, even the threatened deprivation of it can be a powerful weapon against anyone whose security and subsistence is not in fact socially guaranteed." This brings us to an important distinction that we need to understand between formal and substantive access to rights, and the best way to learn about it is with an example. Consider the right to have an abortion. There are some states in the US where you technically have the right to get an abortion. Nobody's going to arrest you for it. But there's only one clinic in the whole state and it's miles away. Oh, and you can't afford to go there. Well then, great. For most of the state's citizens, what's the point of even having that right? The right is merely formal, not substantive, which is just a fancy way of saying that it pretty much only exists on paper. Now, substantive access doesn't mean that there needs to be a clinic open 24/7 on every corner, but it does mean that everyone who has the right needs reliable and, where necessary, protected access to it. If you don't agree that people should have the right to an abortion, well then let's not get bogged down in that today. Swap in whatever right you like and create your own example. Incidentally, this distinction is why if anybody ever says to you, Group X can't be oppressed, name one legal right that Group Y has and Group X doesn't. You can't, the law is the same for both. Then you can safely bet that they know precisely dick about the philosophy of human rights, because they haven't appreciated the distinction between formal and substantive access. And this is what Xu is saying. He's saying that if you don't have what you basically need to survive, then you can't have substantive access to any of your rights. And that's a pretty powerful idea. Think about all the traditional liberal rights, like the right to free speech, freedom of expression, property rights, democracy, even just the right to life. Xu is saying that without guarantees to protect things like healthcare, shelter, and food, all of those things become increasingly pointless. That's why he prefers to think of things like healthcare, shelter, and food not as necessities for survival, but as what he calls your basic rights. The things that you need in order to even begin being entitled to anything else. Things that he thinks should be reliably provided for you. So where does rich and poor come into this? Well, one of the big factors that determines whether you have substantive access to your rights is wealth. Imagine you live in one of those states where you can't afford to get an abortion. Well, someone who can afford to get one essentially has more rights than you do. Formally, on paper, your rights are the same, but the rich person is the only one who can actually count on being able to use theirs. Making sure that everybody has secure access to the substance of their rights takes things like investment, infrastructure, and labor. And right now, those things aren't free. Even if Xu is wrong about having to secure a whole bunch of new rights to things like healthcare, shelter, and food, just securing the rights that the law currently recognizes would require transferring wealth from those with more for the benefit of those with less. Otherwise, we might as well just stop kidding ourselves and admit that your human rights are directly proportional to how much disposable income you have. Of course, we'd still have to answer the questions of how do we conduct that wealth transfer fairly and efficiently, and who gets to decide what counts as helping. There are people who are fine with helping the less fortunate, but they'd rather do it through direct charity than be compelled to by taxation. And there are those who say that they're fine with helping the less fortunate, but they'd rather do it in a way that expands the economic status quo that benefits them, rather than alters that status quo. Like those who say that the solution to third world poverty is trade, not aid. Conveniently, the kind of trade that they stand to profit from. And those are all debates that we could have. But here's the twist. All this talk about whether the rich should help the poor or not has been assuming that right now they're doing neither helping nor hurting could go either way. And that might not be the best way to look at this question. Many people have argued that poverty is not like a natural disaster where it just happens. It's foreseeably inflicted. Global economic systems foreseeably disadvantage huge swathes of people, and we maintain those systems because they are profitable for other people. Kind of like how black slavery was maintained for a long time despite some objection to it, because it was a source of cheap labor, it was very profitable in its heyday, and white people enjoyed having cheap stuff. Nowadays, we know that a lot of our clothing in the West is made by people, and sometimes even children, who maybe don't have much choice in the matter, and maybe don't work in very good conditions, but we don't do as much to end that as we could, because it means we get cheap clothes. We know that carbon-based energy will kill millions of people and create millions of refugees through climate change, but we don't do as much to stop that as we theoretically could, because carbon-based energy is also a profitable business. Asking whether the rich should help the poor might be a very bourgeois philosophy way of looking at this. What do I mean by bourgeois philosophy? Well, the blog Bourgeois Philosophy, which comes recommended, says it's philosophy in the service of economic imperialism, its superstructures, and the people who rally for and benefit from it. It is a particular way of doing philosophy that is first world chauvinist, idealist, individualist, and uncritical of bourgeois liberalism. It's philosophy that doesn't set anyone free or liberate anybody. Rather, it just continues the patterns of exploitation and oppression. It has been argued by some philosophers that this isn't a question of charity so much as a question of justice, and that's a very different way of looking at things. When we do philosophy about things like reparations for slavery or returning land and historical treasures that were stolen through colonialism, the question isn't, should we give back our stuff? The question is, do we even have the right to say what happens to this stuff in the first place? The philosopher Elizabeth Ashford put it like this: the central normative implication of conceiving the duties as duties of justice rather than as duties of beneficence is that it is not appropriate to frame the duties in terms of how much of our resources we should give. Rather, insofar as we are under duties of justice to those suffering severe poverty, those resources are not rightfully ours in the first place. As always in philosophy, it's not just about the answers you reach. You must ask the right questions.
We'll be back after the short break.
Thousands of opinions are at our fingertips. But are all opinions informed? Does your information have a source? Is your social feed based on fact? Only facts can uncover the truth. Professional journalists are committed to balanced and nonpartisan reporting, to independent commentary. They cut through the spin to give you the information and perspective you need. Journalism is essential to democracy, a watchdog over the powerful, an independent voice. Journalism is more important than ever.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM CITR Vancouver, your rich source of skeptical philosophy. And we're back. Next up, we have the answer to a question I bet you didn't know you wanted answered. Most of us know beyond being the dictator of Germany, Hitler was also the author of Mein Kampf. Ever wonder who has the copyright on that? No? Thought not. Let's listen and find out who profited from this tome of hate.
Hello, I'm Simon Whistler. You're watching the Today I Found Our YouTube channel, and in the video today, we're looking at who gets the royalties to Hitler's book. Mein Kampf, the autobiographical anti-Semitic hate manifesto written by Adolf Hitler in the 1920s, is one of the most controversial and infamous books of all time. As you might imagine, this has resulted in millions of copies of the book being sold since Hitler did the world a major favor and heroically, and with no regard for his own personal safety, managed to infiltrate the Führer bunker and take out one of the most hated individuals of all time, himself, in 1945. So, ever since Hitler fired a Walther PPK at his own head, who's been collecting the royalties from sales of the book? How much did Hitler make off it before that? And why did he write it in the first place? Hitler initially began dictating and drafting the outline to Mein Kampf while imprisoned in 1923 after a failed attempt to seize power in Bavaria in a coup d'etat which eventually became known as the Bierhofputsch. Conceived by Hitler as a way of simultaneously spreading Nazi ideals and paying off the massive debts he had racked up, the future Führer realistically expected that his book would only primarily appeal to those who were either in or sympathetic to the National Socialist Party. For the most part, Hitler was right, and upon its release in 1925, it sold a modest 9,000 copies, nevertheless earning him a nice little income. Over the next few years, as Hitler's star rose in German politics, sales of his book similarly increased. Legitimate sales of the book peaked in 1933, the year Hitler became Chancellor of Germany, with a reported 850,000 copies being sold that year. In total, it's estimated that around 10 million copies of the book were sold during Hitler's lifetime. Padding these totals significantly, when Hitler became Führer, leader/guide, millions of copies of the book were purchased by the German government, These were distributed for free to German soldiers and newly married couples. In doing this, Hitler ensured that he earned royalties for every one of the free books handed out by the government by declaring that local authorities had to pay to cover the book's cost before giving them away. It's difficult to determine exactly how much Hitler earned from all of these sales, but according to the documentary Hitler's Money, the total rang in at just under 8 million Reichmarks. Equally difficult, for a variety of reasons, is converting that amount to modern-day dollars or pounds. But as an extremely rough estimate, 8 million Reichmarks in the early 1940s would be the equivalent of around $30 million at that time, or around $430 million, that's £279 million today. Whatever the case, given Hitler's fairly lavish lifestyle in the immediate years leading up to, and then later including, his time as leader of Germany, and with most of his personal income coming from the book sales in the early going, it would seem his bank account was doing all right. Of course, we should note that this doesn't take into account all of the money Hitler later acquired through various other means, such as licensing his image to the German government, earning him money every time they sold a stamp or other item with his face on it. Hitler also maximized his personal income by simply not bothering to pay his taxes. This created something of a problem for him initially, but he managed to string along the German tax office for years, at one point brashly claiming that he only owned one desk and two bookshelves, while simultaneously driving around in a brand new Mercedes. At other times, he kept the tax officials at bay by insisting that it pay off his tax bill in installments over time. This all culminated in Hitler receiving a tax bill of 405,500 Reichmarks shortly after he became Chancellor in 1933. For reference, the average teacher's salary in Germany at the time was a little under 5,000 Reichmarks. Still not wanting to pay his taxes and now being in charge, he promptly had a representative of the Ministry of Finance declare that the Führer was free of tax obligations, and the massive tax debt he'd accumulated was waived, along with future taxes he'd have otherwise had to pay. While sales of Mein Kampf internationally were decidedly more modest, Hitler still made considerable amounts of money from them before the start of World War II, with it being noted that he made somewhere in the region of 500,000 inflation-adjusted dollars from sales of the book in the UK alone. As Hitler was officially a resident of Munich upon his death, the Bavarian government seized all of his property, including the rights to the book, and immediately outlawed its publication in Germany. Despite this, the book is still published and sold with some success in other European countries where it is not banned. As the legal copyright holder, Bavaria is entitled to any royalties from such sales, and they do accept them, albeit begrudgingly, before giving them to charity. That said, when Hitler died, his will instructed that any objects of sentimental value or necessary for the maintenance of a modest, simple life be split amongst his living relatives and friends, while his art collection and remaining assets be split between an art gallery in his hometown of Linz and the National Socialist German Workers' Party, respectively. However, the Bavarian government decided to ignore this will as part of what we like to dub their commendable screw Hitler initiative. They took full ownership of his entire estate. While legally, some of Hitler's distant heirs could lay claim to what remains of Hitler's estate, which is still estimated to be worth millions, none of them are willing to do so. In fact, apart from not wanting anything to do with Hitler's estate, the sons of Hitler's nephew have even gone so far as to agree to never have children to end his bloodline. While rights to Mein Kampf belong to the Bavarian government throughout most of the world, in the UK and the US, things are a little different. In the UK, rights to the book belong to Hurst and Blackett, who purchased rights to publish a translated version of the book from Hitler's publisher in 1933. When Hitler died, Hurst and Blackett retained the rights and continue to sell copies of it to this day, though now under the name Random House, a publisher which bought them out in 1998. However, the company, unwilling to profit off the work of Hitler, has for some time gifted all the royalties made from the book to an anonymous charity. In 2001, it was revealed that the charity in question was the German Welfare Council. That council then stated that they were planning to return £250,000 of the £500,000 they'd received over the years via book royalty donations. This came as a response to the controversy that erupted to their ever having accepted such funds and being confronted by various prominent individuals, including the chairman of the Holocaust Educational Trust, who felt that profiting in any such way from the book was inherently wrong, even if the money was being used for good. The £250,000 they'd already used from the sales of the book had been given to aid Holocaust survivors. The Welfare Council stated of all this, "When we agreed in 1976 to the arrangements, the generally accepted view was that there was a moral obligation to pass the money to Holocaust victims, but no Jewish charity would take it. The current Board of Trustees, however, has decided that the funding is no longer appropriate, not least because we no longer deal exclusively with Holocaust victims. This charity was chosen because of its work with Jewish refugees from Germany, but their number has diminished greatly over the years. Most have simply died of old age. The problem now is that no one wants anything to do with the money." Upon learning that the Welfare Council would be returning the money, Random House decided that they would distribute the unwanted funds and any subsequent royalties to another appropriate charity. As to why the German Welfare Council had so much remaining from the donated book royalties, it was explained that "we kept it in a separate bank account from other donations and used it only in emergencies. Holocaust victims who were helped by the charity may not have known about the donation, and I fear that some might have been offended." In America, royalties to Mein Kampf are collected by Houghton Mifflin, who bought the rights to Hitler's book from his publisher in 1933. Interestingly, at least two other publishers, Stackpole and Renal and Hitchcock, are known to have published unlicensed translations of the book in the 1930s by arguing that because Hitler self-identified as a stateless German, his book wasn't copyrightable. Neither of these publishers paid any royalties to Hitler. In fact, Stackpole advertised the book by explicitly stating Hitler wasn't getting anything from the sales of their version. At the start of World War II, the American government seized all profits and rights to the book within the country. The government then held the rights to Mein Kampf until 1979. During this span, they made about $139,000 in royalties, with this money placed into the War Claims Fund before being paid out to victims of the war. In 1979, Houghton Mifflin paid the US government $37,254 to quietly buy back the rights, earning them an estimated $700,000 in royalties over the next two decades. However, when it emerged that the company had been making hundreds of thousands of dollars from the sale of the book, they issued a statement saying that the royalties the book earned would be distributed to charities that promoted diversity and cross-cultural understanding, and a host of other things Hitler would have hated. Thanks to German copyright law, Mein Kampf entered the public domain on the 1st of January 2016. This means there will likely be even more arguments and controversy about who, if anyone, should profit from Hitler's hymnal of hate.
Thanks to Today I Found Out for that. And from a playbook of hatred to the epoch of humanity, we have in a nutshell explaining what the era of humanity means. Let's listen and learn.
Humans have existed for millions of years as part of nature. But then something changed, and in an incredibly short amount of time, we terraformed this planet and designed it to fit our needs. As far as we know, we're the first beings to awaken and completely take over a planet. The transition from hunting and gathering to farming and building was so breathtakingly fast that many of our ways of thinking about the world are no longer useful. One of our most outdated ideas is that the most commonly used calendar in the world insists that we live in the year 2016. This distorts our view of our own history and makes it harder to understand who we are as a species and just how far we've come in an incredibly short amount of time. So maybe it's time to choose a year zero for humanity. A year zero that truly represents us as a species and includes all cultures. A year zero that marks when we began building our own world on top of the old one. Years ago, hundreds of humans came together in the hills of southern Anatolia. They were hunters and gatherers without knowledge of agriculture or metalworking. All they had were tools made of stone and wood. But they built humanity's first big construction project, 7,000 years before the pyramids were built in Egypt. Spread over 300 meters, our ancestors erected circles of massive stone pillars, each of them up to 6 meters high and 40 tons in weight, decorated with artful pictograms and stone carvings of animals and mythical creatures. We have no idea how they were able to do this. It was probably a project of epic scale for the Stone Age, requiring a level of organization we didn't know early humans were capable of until we found this site. So, why did they build it? The most popular theory is that this was the first temple of humanity, dedicated to long-forgotten gods. We only know that this construction project, the first of its kind, marks the beginning of a new era. It's in this area, around that time, that humans truly began to build their own world, which would make it a fitting milestone in our history for the start of our calendar. This moment in time is so distinct that scientist Cesare Emiliani proposed that humanity should switch to what he called the Holocene calendar by adding 10,000 years to our current Gregorian calendar. We don't need to change our well-established days and months, and religious calendars could stay the same as well. But for all official purposes, our current year would be the year 12,016 of the human era. This would drastically alter how we think about history and how it feels. Let's take a very brief look and move through our new history from our new year zero. 12,000 years ago saw the beginning of the first construction project kicking off our history. It would be in use for about 2,000 years. It took nearly a millennium until Jericho, probably the first city on Earth, was founded in the year 1000 after the start of the human era. Progress was still very, very slow at this point. Over the next 1,000 years, more and more permanent settlements appeared around the world, and more plants and animals were domesticated as agriculture spread. Evidence for trade over thousands of kilometers has been found from this period. Around 5 million humans were alive at this point in history, fewer than live in London today. Technology advanced constantly at a slow pace. Pottery became widespread. The first cultural communities appeared in China, India, and the Fertile Crescent. Around the year 4000, 8000 years ago from today, humans started to use metal for the first time, learning to mix tin and copper, and kick-starting what we know as the Bronze Age around the year 5000. The first proto-writing emerged, and the wheel was invented. In South America, the Chinchorro culture started to artificially mummify humans 2000 years earlier than in ancient Egypt. The first high cultures began emerging around the year 7000. The Indus Valley Civilization, ancient Egypt, the Minoans in Greece, and the Sumerians in Mesopotamia. Stonehenge was built in Britain, and the first dynasty in China began. Ötzi the Iceman lived around this time. What we consider history now started, and things began picking up pace as the world population rose to over 30 million. A number of new high cultures appeared around the world, many writing down their legends. More and more cities were founded. In South America, the Olmec culture emerged. Around this time, the legendary Siege of Troy is supposed to have happened. Soon after, in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Fertile Crescent, the Bronze Age ended in violence. Every Bronze Age culture, except Egypt, was destroyed by mysterious invaders. Writing and progress froze for hundreds of years. Around the year 9500, what we consider Western culture began. The Greek city-states beat off the Persian invasion and triggered their golden era, ended by Alexander the Great around 9700. 100 years later, Rome destroyed Carthage and became a dominant force in the world. Caesar was murdered in the year 9956, while the world population had risen to about 300 million people. And it's only now, around the year 10,000, that we've reached the point where the Gregorian calendar and our current method of marking human history begins. A mere 2,000 years from now, humans will walk on the moon. If we think about history as we do now, we are underplaying 10,000 years of human progress and development. Including all of it in our calendar makes our past more impressive. It shows how progress became exponential with time, and it incorporates all humans from all cultures into our calendar. A new year zero for our history could reframe how we think of ourselves. As a building project that started 12,000 years ago, when for the first time our ancestors came together to carve a temple out of bedrock with tools made of stone, not knowing what they would set in motion, where it would lead us as a species. From building the first temple to ships flying beyond the sky.
We'll return after this break.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, year one of skeptical broadcasting in Vancouver. And we're back. Our penultimate clip is from It's Okay to Be Smart, about six chemical reactions that changed humanity. Let's listen and learn.
Physics might show us the universe's basic building blocks, and biology lets the universe understand itself. But chemistry is where all the fun happens in between. We have thousands of chemical reactions going on inside us every second, but it's the ones we've mastered with our hands, in labs and workshops and factories and even kitchens, that have made humans what we are today. A few chemical technologies have made such an explosive change in how we live that they've altered the very trajectory of humanity. Here's six chemical reactions that changed history. Fire was our first foray into chemistry, for better and for worse. Whether it's animal, vegetable, or whatever's in Hot Pockets, cooking our food makes it easier to digest. We get more nutrition for a lot less work. But there's a different bit of chemistry that turns food from simple nutrition into something fun to eat. In 1913, a French chemist named Louis-Camille Maillard described the most delicious reaction that I know of. Pretty much everything we cook contains sugars and amino acids, and when they react at high temperatures, the result is, well, hundreds and hundreds of complex flavor compounds. It's what browns grilled hamburgers, puts crispy crust on pizza, the golden edges on French fries. Sorry, I got a little carried away there. Anyway. Sure, harnessing fire made food more digestible, but the Maillard reaction made it more fun to eat and to drink. Because really, where would we be without roasted coffee?
Dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria!
They say sticks and stones can break bones, but metal does it better. If your ancestors didn't figure out the chemistry of bronze, they were probably conquered by someone who did. The only pure metals that Earth has any good amount of are copper, gold, silver, and platinum. But unfortunately, they're all either too valuable, too heavy, or too soft to make good pokey sticks with. Beginning 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, people began alloying or mixing copper with elements like tin to make bronze, a step up in hardness and durability from pure copper. It was later replaced by iron in most uses, but bronze was the beginning of humanity's heavy metal stage. You like civilization? I'm a big fan myself, and one reaction above all others made it possible. As the poet John Ciardi put it, fermentation and civilization are inseparable. Our ancestors eventually got tired of chasing dinner and were finally able to put their roots down by putting some roots down. Domesticating plants led to a nice, orderly system where a few people grew enough food for everyone, giving the others free time to explore things like art, advanced government, and even science, or at least what passed for science at the time. But eating raw grain is not our thing. And what good is that harvest if it'll be rotten in a couple weeks? By harnessing fermentation and converting sugars into acids, alcohol, and gas, our ancestors let tiny creatures they had no idea even existed turn fruit, vegetables, and grain, even milk, into forms that were tastier and lasted longer. You know what's also nice? Drinkable water. But for most of human history, drinking from the wrong stream or well could get you the last stomach ache you'd ever have. Fermentation and its antimicrobial alcoholic byproducts were your friend. Considering water used to be an actual health hazard, it's no surprise that bathing often wasn't high on priority lists of the past. But nobody wants to sit with the smelly kid, even in ancient Sumeria. Tablets dating from nearly 4,000 years ago there show formulas for mixing water, alkali ash, and oil or animal fat to make soap. Plant and animal oils are triglycerides, a glycerol molecule plus three fatty acids. You break them apart with the alkali base, and you get fatty acid salts, the key ingredient in soap, because they dissolve both ways. One end is attracted to water, and the other attracts greasy nonpolar things. And the resulting chemical mix is perfect for using water to pull olive oil stains out of your favorite toga. Newsflash, computers are a big deal, and neither cell phones or smart thermostats would be possible without silicon chips. Silicon is actually super easy to find, but to be used in chips, it has to be super pure. How pure? At least 99's pure. But that's not even the hard part. Pure solid silicon is a mass of billions of separate crystals. It looks cool, but everywhere two crystals meet is a place where semiconductor magic can't happen. The Sharovsky process makes that mess chip-worthy. The silicon is remelted, and a single tiny crystal is lowered in and slowly drawn out. This first crystalline seed aligns the growing solid mass in a single perfect crystal of silicon, ready to be sliced and diced and put to good use. Everything that's alive needs nitrogen in order to build the most basic bits of life, like amino acids and DNA. But for most of life's history, converting nitrogen to biologically useful forms could only be done by bacteria in soil. They pull gas from the air and convert it to building blocks like ammonia and nitrates. That was until 1909, when German chemist Fritz Haber, with the help of a couple friends, figured out how to do it on our own. The Haber-Bosch process converts nitrogen gas and hydrogen gas, two simple ingredients, to make ammonia, which we can then turn into an infinite list of useful stuff. So why is this number one? Fertilizer. For the first time, farmers didn't have to rely on crop rotation or shovel what the family cow provided them to get nitrogen. Inexpensive chemical fertilizers let many people grow abundant food for the first time ever. The world grew so much food, in fact, that the global population has more than quadrupled since this chemical revolution. We make 450 million tons of nitrogen fertilizer this way every year. A full 1 to 2% of all the energy we use goes to this process. Now, of course, salad bars and cereal aren't the only thing that we make with industrial nitrogen. Nitrates are necessary ingredients in making explosives, and the Haber process allowed nations involved in World War I and II to unleash destruction on scales never seen before. But whether it was the battlefield or the breakfast table that really motivated Haber to harness nitrogen from air, one explosion definitely won out over the other, and it's just one delicious bit of chemistry that feeds our brains every day.
And our final clip is from SciShow about five baffling mysteries of the universe. Let's listen and learn.
At the beginning of the 20th century, many scientists started thinking that physics was pretty much over. Sure, there were a few unsolved mysteries left, but it seemed like they could all be ironed out with better measurements, or maybe with very slight tweaks to what was already known. The problem was, those mysteries didn't go away with better measurements and slight tweaks. They led to fundamental revolutions in our understanding of nature, huge important things like relativity and quantum mechanics. Now that we've discovered those things, though, it might sometimes feel like there are, once again, just a few small problems left for physicists to solve before we can say we know everything. thing about how the universe works. But here are five of those problems that are actually a really big deal and aren't going to go down without a fight. Neutrinos are tiny subatomic particles. There are trillions of them flying through you every second, but they hardly ever hit one of your atoms. Like, even a 14,000 metric ton neutrino detector will only detect a few neutrinos a day. As strange as that might be, physicists mostly understand why neutrinos don't often interact with ordinary matter. What they don't understand is why neutrinos have mass, or why that mass is so small. Particle physicists use the Standard Model, which uses math to describe how every known particle interacts with every other known particle. It's one of the most successful models in history. The Standard Model correctly predicts the results of literally trillions of experiments. The problem is, the Standard Model also predicts that neutrinos shouldn't have any mass. But in the 1990s, physicists studying neutrinos coming from the sun realized that neutrinos had to have mass. There are a few different kinds of neutrinos, and the researchers found that the neutrinos coming from the sun were switching types, but they would need mass to be able to do that switching, which means that the Standard Model has a pretty big hole in it. Now, there is a way of changing the equation used in the Standard Model so that it includes neutrinos with mass. So on its own, the fact that neutrinos have mass doesn't necessarily have to be a deal breaker. But neutrinos' masses are also incredibly tiny compared to every other fundamental particle out there. Electrons are the next lightest particles we found, and they're still somewhere between 126,000 and 600 million times heavier than the lightest neutrinos. That huge gap makes a lot of physicists think that fitting neutrinos with mass into the current Standard Model is a little bit like shoving sugar packets under a leg of a wobbly table and saying you fixed it. There are a few other possible explanations out there that also fit with the Standard Model, but so far, we haven't found any solid evidence to support them. Other physicists think that we need to throw out the Standard Model altogether and turn to new models to explain the mysterious masses. Another possible solution to the neutrino mass problem could help solve a second mystery. Why is there so much matter in the universe? See, matter has a sort of twin called antimatter. Antimatter particles are just like regular matter particles, except they have the opposite charge. So regular matter has electrons, for example, which have a negative charge, but antimatter has what are called positrons, which are just like electrons, except with a positive charge. And whenever a particle of matter meets its corresponding particle of antimatter, they annihilate each other in a big explosion. The problem is, matter and antimatter act the same in a lot of ways, as long as they're kept separate from each other. Like, when we do experiments in particle accelerators and produce particles of matter, we produce particles of antimatter too. Antimatter can even make atoms, just like normal matter can. The laws of physics just don't seem to prefer one over the other. But when we look out into the universe, all we see is ordinary matter, like the stuff down here on Earth. There are no antimatter stars, no antimatter galaxies, and no antimatter dust clouds. If there were, they'd occasionally run into similar pieces of matter, and they'd annihilate each other in a big flash. But we don't see those flashes. So why didn't the universe start out with equal amounts of matter and antimatter that then annihilated each other with nothing left over? There are a lot of possibilities, and some of them have to do with our old friends, neutrinos. Because remember how neutrinos are so weirdly light? If there were also incredibly heavy neutrinos, they would balance out the light neutrinos by creating a whole family that kind of averages out at a more reasonable mass. These heavy neutrinos would have been around just after the Big Bang, when they would have decayed into smaller, lighter particles, and in the process, produced slightly more matter particles than antimatter particles. So if heavy neutrinos did actually exist, that could help solve two mysteries at once. First, it might explain why neutrinos have such tiny masses, and second, it would explain why there's matter all over the universe instead of antimatter. It would be such a nice, elegant solution. The only problem is, none of our experiments have found evidence for it. Let's zoom way out now, from subatomic particles to whole galaxies. Since gravity comes from mass, astronomers can use the amount of matter they detect in a galaxy to calculate how strong its gravity should be. But they've known for almost a century that they must be missing something. Stars orbit the center of galaxies so fast that the galaxy's calculated gravity shouldn't be strong enough to hold on to them. These stars should escape into intergalactic space, but they don't. So there must be some extra source of gravity out there holding galaxies together. Astronomers call this source dark matter. And unlike antimatter, we have no idea what dark matter is made of. All they really know is that dark matter interacts with regular matter through the gravitational force and that it seems invisible to telescopes. Also, it makes up about 85% of the matter in the universe. Now, there is a much simpler possibility. What if astronomers are just wrong about the laws of gravity? Maybe if they found the right laws, they could explain everything without needing dark matter. But dark matter just explains too many things too well, from the way that galaxies are distributed on a large scale to the way that matter clumped together just after the Big Bang. Plus, astronomers have actually found pockets of dark matter that are completely separated from any visible matter. In other words, they've seen gravitational effects that should be caused by matter in places where there's no detectable matter. Even changing the laws of gravity wouldn't explain that. So dark matter definitely exists, we just don't know what it is. But we do know what it isn't. For example, lots of people used to think that dark matter was probably just a lot of really dim, ordinary matter, like small failed stars called brown dwarfs, or even neutrinos. But experiments have ruled out a lot of those sorts of options. There are still plenty of other ideas out there waiting in the wings for upcoming experiments, but for now, 85% of the matter in the universe remains completely unexplained. There's also something weird about matter itself. Starting about a second after the Big Bang and lasting for about 3 minutes, protons and neutrons came together in the first ever atomic nuclei. Physicists can use what they know about particle physics and the early universe to predict how much of each element should have formed this way. Hydrogen, for example, has just a single proton in its nucleus, and because it's so simple, about 70% of the atoms in the universe should be hydrogen. And that's exactly what astronomers see when they look at old stars. That same model also predicts that protons and neutrons should have come together to form helium about 27% of the time, so 27% of the atoms should have been helium. Again, exactly what astronomers see when they check. And just about every element they look at matches in the same way. And then there's lithium. One form of lithium, called lithium-7, has 3 protons and 4 neutrons. And astronomers see 4 times less of it than the model predicts. This huge difference makes them think there must be something wrong with either the model or the measurements, or both. Astronomers make a few assumptions about the early universe in order to predict how much of each element was produced. Then, to measure how much of each of those elements is actually out there, they use the light from stars, where again they have to make some assumptions about things like the star's temperature and stability. They could try to change some of those assumptions to fit lithium, but there's a problem. These assumptions work so well for the other elements that tweaking them to fit lithium screws everything else up. So a lot of physicists think the lithium problem means that there's some part of physics that we're missing, like the idea of supersymmetry, which says that every particle has a kind of twin sibling with a much larger mass. Then there's another idea that the things we think are constants of nature, and basically set in stone, aren't actually constant. If supersymmetry is real, that would mean there were more particles in the early universe. And if the things we think are set in stone actually aren't, that would change how the particles interacted. So both could help explain the weird lithium numbers, if we ever find evidence for them. But so far, we haven't found any. The cosmic microwave background, or CMB, is the oldest light in the universe. It's often represented as a pattern of reds and blues, which show the different densities of matter that eventually led to big structures like our galaxy. The CMB was a really important discovery in the 1960s because it helped confirm the Big Bang theory, but it also hides an axis of evil. And yes, that's actually what scientists call it, the axis of evil. See, researchers expect that matter in the early universe shouldn't have been bunched up too much in any one place or direction, but that's not what they see in the CMB. Instead, they see a kind of split between a more dense half and a less dense half, with an axis of evil between the two. And when they try to divide up the CMB in other more complicated ways than just seeing which half is denser, the axis of evil is still there. At first, astronomers thought there must have been something wrong with the measurements, or maybe that there was something like a nearby dust cloud that was messing things up. But they've checked and checked and checked, and they can't get rid of this axis. To make things even weirder, the axis of evil lines up with the plane of our solar system. We point right at it. And that's just bizarre. Astronomy is guided by something called the Copernican principle, which says that there's no reason our place in the universe should be special. But lining up with a cosmological axis that formed billions of years before Earth did seems like it puts us in a pretty special place. Now, it's completely possible that there's nothing weird about the alignment at all. There's probably about a 1 in 1,000 chance that the conventional Big Bang model would produce a universe with matter bunched up like it is in the CMB. Those odds aren't too bad. And with trillions of planets orbiting trillions of stars throughout the universe, someone was bound to line up with the axis of evil. So maybe we just got lucky. And besides, the alignment isn't perfect, it's just surprisingly good. But scientists still want to know why this axis exists, and whether there's a reason our solar system lines up with it. Unfortunately, they haven't come up with much. None of these mysteries will be easy to solve, but there are lots of smart people working on all of them, and sometimes even on 2 or more at once. So maybe someday soon, I'll be telling you about the solutions to some of these problems. But in the meantime, they'll keep reminding us that there's still a lot we don't know about the universe.
And that's all the time we have this week. Hope you learned something. And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond.
to sky-high gas prices, we can convince America that more drilling is the answer. High gas prices? Drill more. Prices still high? Try drilling in a wildlife refuge or off a nice beach.
Our traditional energy resources are limited. Luckily, it's easy for students like you to conserve energy.
Woke up late for class? Buy some time in the morning by taking a shorter shower. Cut down by 1 minute every day and save enough to fund your daily caffeine fix for over a week. Plus, you save on electricity and water. Install a water-saving showerhead to save even more.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
To CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of British Columbia, located on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. My name is Josh. You are listening to Textbook. This is a show